Thank you for listening to Scandinavian Crimes Podcast. Be sure to check out the episode links and be part of our other social media platforms where you can leave a topic suggestion or even share some of your insights regarding the subject matter of the episode. We will always do our best to provide a well-researched episode, but sometimes due to limited access to information and translation issues, some information can be lost. It is therefore good to do your own research and get a deeper understanding of a case of your own interest. So with that all said, let us start today's episode.
Welcome to another episode of Scandinavian Crimes. My name is Devante, and say hello to my lovely co-host, Delilah.
Hi.
And on today's episode, we are talking about famous Scandinavian criminals who made their mark throughout Scandinavian history. So this case is a very, it's about a serial killer. And I know you guys love serial killers. Now, Tommy Tonelli Nakati, born 1967, is a Finnish serial killer known for the murders of his common law wife, mother, and girlfriend between 1992 and 2008. He was ultimately convicted of manslaughter for his final crime and received 14 and a half years as a prison sentence. Despite Nakati's claim that he didn't remember much of any of the murders, the evidence still led him to his conviction. So with that being said, this is going to be one of the first cases we kind of deal with when it comes to someone not remembering or claiming not to have remembered their crime. So this is going to be new territory for us. So I hope you enjoy the story and grab your snacks, grab your tea, do what you got to do to get real comfortable, real cozy if you're on your way to work. Let's really dive into this as we discuss and break down the story of Tommy Nakati. On August 17th, 1992, Nakati and his common law wife embarked on a trip to Helsinki with the intention of enjoying their recently received unemployment benefits. However, they changed their plans and ended up in Paiksamaki, where they spent the night at various bars and restaurants, drinking alcohol with some friends. When all the establishments were about to close for the night, Nakati and his wife decided to travel back to their place in Mikkeli. At the train station, they coincidentally encountered an ex-convict who happened to be traveling to Mikkeli as well. They started having a conversation when, for unknown reason, Nakati and his wife engaged in a heated argument, resulting in Nakati storming off and leaving his wife behind with the ex-convict. Nakati spent the rest of the night at a nearby grill bar continuing with his drinking. The following morning, Nakati, still feeling the effects of the hangover, decided to consume copious amounts of beer along with a bottle of lorazepam in an attempt to lower his hangover discomfort. Concerned about his wife's well-being, Nakati stumbled back to his residence. When he came home, the wife explained that she had spent the previous night in jail and had been released from custody. However, Nakati didn't believe the wife's explanation and thought she cheated on him with the ex-convict. This disbelief and his jealousy led to a heated argument during which he started to consume various medical pills he had in his home. In a defiant act, he proceeded to chew on his medication, which only added more fuel to the fire. The wife then pleaded with Nakati, desperately urging him to refrain from taking any more medication. This angered Nakati even more, and in a moment of rage, Nakati grabbed a long-bladed knife and brutally stabbed her. She was stabbed 10 times with such force that the knife went through her body. He then ended his horrendous attack by cutting her throat. With the wife's body on the floor and his hands and clothes covered in her blood, he covered the body with a cloth and some towels before he went to bed, falling asleep. After a few days, Nakati woke up with no memory of what happened. As he entered the bedroom, a horrifying sight was seen: bloodstains splattered across the walls and his wife's motionless body lying on the floor. Realizing that he had killed his wife, feelings of guilt and despair overwhelmed him. He cut his wrist, hoping to end his torment, but the bleeding stopped due to the cut not being deep enough. Desperate for an escape from his unbearable reality, he tried to hang himself. However, he failed yet again and decided to live with the truth that he had murdered his wife. During the same day, Nakati wandered into town, concealing his dark secret within the depths of his troubled soul. At Alko, he purchased liquor and bought pills from an acquaintance to numb his pain. To finance his self-destructive habits, Nakati resorted to selling various possessions like the TV and some of the books in his home. This desperate cycle of intoxication and selling continued for a week until he finally got caught. The police apprehended Nicotti and they brought him back to the apartment, but as they opened and entered the door, a nauseating stench permeated the air. The wife's body had reached an advanced state of decomposition, adding another layer of horror to an already tragic incident. The investigation into Nicotti's crime began immediately, with the police collecting evidence and interviewing witnesses. The initial investigation revealed that the woman had been brutally stabbed in various parts of her body, totaling in at least 21 wounds. During the trial, the family of the victim provided testimony revealing that Nicotti had allegedly made threats to harm or kill his wife when she was alive. This revelation came as a surprise to many, considering that they had only been living together for a short period of time. Nicotti stood before the judge, the weight of his actions bearing heavily upon him as he had listened to the testimonies of those who had known his wife, painting a vivid picture of the life she had lost. Prior to the trial, Nicotti was taken to a healthcare legal security center where he was evaluated and received a diagnosis of personality disorder. Due to this, Nicotti's defense attorney argued for leniency, highlighting his client's mental state at the time of the crime and emphasizing his lack of prior criminal history. On the other hand, the prosecution sought justice for the victim, using the evidence and urging the judge to deliver a harsh punishment to ensure that such a heinous act would never be repeated again. The McKelley District Court sentenced Nicotti for murder with 12 years and 4 months in prison. However, upon review, the Eastern Finland Court of Appeal reclassified the charge to manslaughter, taking into account the lack of remembrance of the murder and him having no prior criminal record. The diagnosis of personality disorder played a big part in decision-making as well. Acknowledging the complexities of this case, it ended up resulting in a reduction of over 4 years on his sentence, making it a total of 8 years he would spend behind bars. After being released from prison in the autumn of 1998, Nicotti made his way back to his mother's home. The atmosphere was tense as the months went by, and one day, a heated argument erupted between Nicotti and his mother regarding cleaning. Fueled by alcohol and a deep-seated anger, Nicotti's emotions boiled over, and he unleashed his fury upon his very own mother. The force of his assault was powerful enough to send her crashing to the ground, leaving her disoriented and in pain. He then grabbed a kitchen knife and scissors at the counter of the kitchen bench and rushed to his mother to stab her 19 times. He viciously targeted her neck and face and stopped at the 19th stab. Similar to his previous murder with his wife, he moved the body to the washroom and covered her with a cloth and some towels. Eventually, Nicotti was apprehended again, and the law enforcement found the murdered mother lying there. During both the investigation and the trial, Nicotti once again claimed to have no recollection of the murder. However, McKell District Court sentenced Nicotti to 10 years and 8 months in prison, yet it was not for murder, but for manslaughter and assault. After his parole release in June 2006, Nicotti returned to McKelley and crossed paths with a young woman named Anna Amelia. Despite warnings from her loved ones about Nicotti's troubled past, Anna continued to see him. They even made some future plans for a vacation to India in the winter of 2008 when Nicotti would be free. On January 10th, 2008, the couple rented a summer cottage in McKelley with the intention of visiting Nicotti's relatives. They were traveling by car, and as they drove towards their destination, the atmosphere between the couple drastically shifted. What started as a pleasant drive soon escalated into a heated argument. In the heat of the moment, consumed by anger, Nicotti reached for a knife. He then aggressively struck Anna several times on the upper arm. The blade grazed her arm, but he could not deal any substantial damage as he was focused on driving. Shocked and startled, Anna held her arm, which was throbbing in pain. As they arrived at the cottage, Nicotti's violent behavior continued. He again attempted to stab her, but she managed to repel some of the blows with her hand. Overwhelmed by rage, Nicotti launched a more violent attack, overpowering and incapacitating Anna. After she fell to the ground, he proceeded to strangle her until her final breath. He then left her lifeless body in the yard. A couple of days have passed by, and Anna's parents started to get worried when they were unable to reach her. They immediately contacted the police and filed a missing persons report, fearing the worst. They anxiously awaited any information that could lead them to the whereabouts of Anna. After Anna's parents reported her disappearance, the Jyväskylä police were immediately notified and requested assistance from the Mikkeli police. It took 5 days of searching until on January 15th, Anna was found dead. She was in the same place where Nikati had left her 5 days prior, unmoved in the yard of the rented cottage. However, Nikati, the primary suspect, was nowhere to be found at the scene. An arrest warrant was issued for Nikati, and a manhunt commenced. Despite Nikati's attempts to evade capture, the police in Kuopio successfully apprehended him in March. Surprisingly, he offered no resistance during the arrest. He was subsequently brought to trial, where the evidence against him was thoroughly presented once again. In 2009, Nikati was sentenced to 14 and a half years in prison for his involvement in Anna's death. The sentence is to be served in full with no possibility of parole. The court also ordered Nikati to pay 16,000 euros in reparations to Anna's grieving family. Although Nikati appealed the sentence, the Eastern Finland court ultimately upheld the original ruling, ensuring that justice was served for Anna and her family. Anna's disappearance had a profound impact on Tommy, Nikati's sister. The sister had a close bond with Anna prior to her disappearance and had been in contact with her. The sister strongly believes that jealousy played a significant role in the tragedy that unfolded. Due to Nikati's previous violent acts of murdering their mother, the sister had limited contact with him. Furthermore, she was filled with fury over Nikati's senseless acts of violence and holds him responsible for taking her mother and her children's grandmother away from them. She expresses frustration over Nikati's relatively quick release from prison and questions how good behavior can lead to a swift return to civilian life. Before the murder, their sister was supposed to visit Anna, and she now wonders if this tragedy could have been prevented if she did.
There's a lot of things I want to talk about this one, because there's so many aspects of this case. So if we just look at the first and second murder, so the first one being with his previous, or the first wife, and the second one with his mother, they're quite similar in a way where he was drinking and was heavily medicated, or like almost like drugged or whatever you can call it, to the point where his aggression was showcasing and he started just doing those things, right? And to me, it's also like one side of me is like, okay, but I guess you are addicted to it, but why would you drink so much and like to be so heavily medicated to the point you can't even remember anything, if that is even true? So like, to me, it sounded like the reason he got lower sentences the first and the second time was because, or he wasn't really charged with murder the first and second one, was because he couldn't remember, or it was an act that happened because he was drunk or medicated. But he did the same thing again with the mother, and they, even though they gave him a little higher of a sentence, it still was not classified as murder. It was classified as manslaughter because he wasn't conscious, or he didn't remember and everything. But if you compare it to the second murder, which is Anna, there's no real like information that he was drunk or anything, or medicated. He was driving, so he must have been conscious enough to be able to drive. And then he was kind of like hurting her because he got mad and jealous. So I just want to point out the difference there, that the Anna murder was very different with the first two murders, because it didn't seem like he was heavily medicated or drunk in that manner. And he, and you know, Anna was dodging the hits pretty well, but you know, you can't escape if you're in a
deserted location with this guy, you know, he was eventually going to catch her. So, you know, it's a sad thing that he was, it seemed again, failed system where he was released repeatedly. He got lower sentence, even though it's up towards 8 and 10 years, it's still a lower sentence. And he didn't feel like he got the help that he needed because he repeated the crimes again. And also, the last thing that I wanted to talk about was the how he was able to get away with a lot of things until this latest murder with Anna, where he tried to escape. So he was like aware, and he was like, oh, I need to escape, I don't want to go back to prison kind of mentality. And he got caught eventually again. So it's like, I don't know, I have mixed feelings about this, because on the first murder he wanted to commit suicide because he felt bad about what he did, but on the other murders he was just like, yeah, okay, I don't want to go back to jail, like, oh no, this happened again. Like, he doesn't take consideration of, like, the consequences of his actions compared to the first one. But he might be lying and stuff too. Maybe him cutting his wrist was not really him. Maybe the wife trying to defend herself, like, and then you got this marks somewhere and stuff. I don't know. One part of me can't believe it, and one part of me just kind of believe some parts of it, that there's like some lies and some truth in what he's saying. What do you think, Devontae?
Well, they said that he has personality disorder. It seems like he fits the symptoms.
Yeah, but if that is actually true as well, you know.
A personality disorder doesn't necessarily mean it's an excuse, and also it doesn't mean as well that he is going to forget. I don't believe he forgot any of the things he did. I just think it happened very quickly. But the personality disorder, I think that fits his profile, this is my personal opinion. He does fit a lot of the antisocial personality disorder traits, where he doesn't really have a concern for the feelings of others. You know, he's willing to lie, steal, and con others. Repeated run-ins with the laws, often violates the rights of others, acts aggressive and violent, has little, if any, concern for other people's safety, completely impulsive, completely reckless, and doesn't really have any regret outside of just he himself getting caught. And that sounds kind of like what he has, like an antisocial personality disorder, which often can be a sign of what he's classified as, you know, like a serial killer, someone who was an unintelligent serial killer. He was someone who was an impulsive serial killer, where his emotions just took over and was rampant, and things escalated quickly. He had no control over what he thought, what he felt, and he was an absolute danger to society. And this is also indicative, once again, of the system kind of failing to realize how much of a threat this person can be. Because once you classify someone with a personality disorder, whether it be antisocial personality disorder or even something less, I guess, in a sense, harmful to society, like BPD, for example, it's still something worth monitoring when you have someone who has issues controlling themselves. And because that can evolve into something else. Now, obviously, there are people who live with BPD, obviously, and that's not nearly as drastic as like antisocial personality disorder. I'm just giving an example how like any form of personality disorder needs to be taken seriously and evaluated. And it should have been considered the second they classified that he had a disorder, because he went to kill more people when this problem could have been solved if he was not on the street. Because they would know that he is incapable, his version of the personality disorder, he's incapable of feeling guilt or his concern for anybody else outside of, you know, himself. So, you know, to be honest, I don't have a ton to say about it, because, you know, we've said this over and over and over again with other cases. It's mostly just the system, especially, you know, this is back in the 90s.
In this case, it's a failed system thing.
Yes.
Like, but this is quite recent, though. So this is not like the other ones where it was like in the 80s or, you know, between the 60s and the 80s. This case specifically is actually like late 90s up till like now, or like 2010 or 2008, whatever it was.
Well, I will say,
so this is quite recent, and they still kind of failed in a way.
Even though this is the 90s, like, which is, you know, by definition, I was born in the 90s. I'm about to turn 30, which means that was like 30 years ago. And the criminal justice system, even in the 90s, for most countries, including the US, including Europe, was still drastically different. There was so much things that they were not doing that needed to be done. Most of the, you know, prison reform and the court reform and laws and stuff like that, most of that reform didn't even happen until post 2008, when people really started to realize, like, oh, there's really some people out there who need help, or these laws are causing people to kind of get away with this stuff. Like, that was when truly a lot of this reform took place with laws, and we're still kind of reforming some things as we go along. But we went a long time without properly enforcing what needs to be enforced, especially when it came to mental health and people in this situation specifically. The system so many times fell short with people with this type of mental illness and how much damage they can do in such a short time. And it's just, it's crazy. I felt like it's common sense. You know, if someone tells you, a professional tells you, this person is prone to this type of behavior, you might think you can get a judge or some, or even the jury or whatever the situation is, to pay attention to like what's going on. Like, this is going to be a problem later on. But, you know, unfortunately, that's how things were for a very long time. And it wasn't until recently that things started to change. So, you know, I'm not going to drag out my explanation any longer, but it's truly just a failed system, a system that needed to be fixed. And unfortunately, it took the death of multiple people for this man to stay behind bars to protect even more people. They could have just honestly, truthfully stopped it at one person, but the system just did not come through the way it should have because of, you know, just lack of common sense, ignorance, and all that stuff. So that's what I got to say about it.
I think that I would have liked to know more about the psychiatric evaluation, like what they did or what they tried to do to prevent it. But we had like there were not enough information. I wish I could have provided more information, but there was very limited. I guess it's because how I guess these cases were kind of private. So the only reason it got famous was because of the latest case, which was the death or murder of Anna. But I would have liked to have more understanding of what they tried to do to prevent it, because it seemed like on the last murder, he was sober, or he wasn't really drinking or was like medicated in any way. So that's pretty much what I want to say. It just seemed like a failed system. Of him not getting the help that was needed for him to not repeat a crime again. So they kind of just put him in jail for, or in prison for, with no parole. So, yeah.
And I will say this every episode I have the opportunity to. Ladies, please, if you're going to deal with someone, be sure to know who they are and, you know, their history. Especially, a lot of this stuff is public knowledge. If your mother tells you this man has been to prison for violent crimes, for killing partners, for killing people, please don't be like, oh, he's different with me, oh, I changed him. Do not do it. Do not take that risk, because one thing is, yes, I believe people can change. I do believe people can change. However, most of the time, most people on the planet, unfortunately, most people don't change. They just become better at masking parts of themselves as they move along. And this doesn't even just apply only to criminals, even to regular everyday people. People only change when they want to change. So please don't go in situations like this thinking like, hey, it's going to be okay, it's going to be different. No, it's not going to be different unless that person wants it to be different. And I mean, truly wants it to be different. Pay attention. I know it sucks, but please pay attention. Please, 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 please. I cannot reiterate this enough. Pay attention. Read when the signs and the writing is on the wall. It will save your life. Please.
Even his own sister didn't really like, you know, even she was like, I don't like him, you know. So it was, that's just a red flag to me, honestly. And also, obviously, for him murdering the mother. But I guess he didn't really say that to his, to Anna.
But her mother knew. So just pay attention, please. It'll save your life. Don't be ignorant to details that are available to you. Please, 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 please. I'll say it one more time. Please pay attention. All right. So I guess we can wrap up the episode with, you know, a little, you know, the good vibes as we usually do. Something like food related. What are you feeling today? What are you feeling today?
Soup with bread.
Soup again?
Yeah. It's because I'm feeling for soup.
I guess I feel you. I am feeling... what is something? Let me know what my taste buds going for. I think I actually have something, a craving for something very simple. I can go for a patalio right now. Like just a little vibe. You know, a little dollar patalio with the beef inside, with the fried dough. And, you know, it's very good. Yeah, and I can definitely go for that right now.
That sounds nice.
It's very good. It's delicious. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please be sure to, you know, once again, follow us on social media. But also please pay attention. Just be mindful of your surroundings, the people in your life, and their intentions for you. And if you get an inkling of a red flag, just open your eyes. Pay attention, please. Especially ladies, but this can apply obviously to men as well. But just in general, please pay attention, people. And be safe out there. I hope you have a great day. Wonderful day. I hope you and your family stay healthy. And we shall see you in the next one. Anything else you want to say? Or that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah.
We're good. So... Yes. We shall holla at y'all next week. Peace out.